On the 24th of February 2022, Russian forces invaded Ukraine. The initial attempt was to depose the Zelensky regime in which little military force would be required. The opposite happened. The Zelensky regime consolidated and the Ukrainian armed forces fought successfully, especially in the first and second phases. The last 6 weeks of fighting has taken place in and around major urban areas in Ukraine. Kyiv, Kharkiv, Mariupol and Kherson have been decisive, and the Battle of Slovyansk is about to begin. Urban fighting has been at the forefront, quite in contrast with Russian expectations. The Ukrainian fighters have operated from urbanized fortresses using Javelin missiles. Why is this interesting? Well, if we look at Western military history and Western military doctrine for the last century, what we find is that urban warfare, in fact, is the subordinated element of military operations. From the First World War onwards, and indeed we could trace it back before the First World War, armies sought to fight out in the field and sought to win through large-scale maneuvers facilitated by the tank. The Battle of France would be an excellent example of the 1940, where the Wehrmacht sought to punch its way through with its large, heavy armoured divisions through the French and British lines and did so successfully. And this pattern of using large-scale manoeuvre in the field was a recurrent feature of 20th century warfare. The last example of this is the 2003 American invasion of Iraq, where the Americans mounted a very impressive assault on Baghdad. What has shocked the Russians is the potency of the urban defense, blunting heavy attack in the field. The lesson of Ukraine will be Western armies need to reverse their traditional expectation of maneuver in the field towards a military operation which has more in common with medieval than with modern warfare, that the siege operation to defend that fortress has taken priority over every other form of land warfare.
Technology often plays a critical role in the changing nature of war. In the U.S. Civil War, improvements in the accuracy of the rifle made defense easier and forced armies to attack in new ways. What was the change in technology that moved fighting with heavy armor in the field to urban warfare?
The proliferation of long-range precision weaponry and the unmanned drone is a key enabler here in terms of surveilling and then targeting and then actually striking forces in the edges of urban areas. And this has pushed urban defense into the fore. There's two other really important factors. Cities are a lot bigger and there's a lot more of them. 1960, 0.5 of a billion people lived in cities. Today, 3.5 billion. There's been a massive expansion of urban areas, and they have become operationally unavoidable. Not only are weapons more lethal, more precise, longer range, not only are cities bigger, more sprawling, and more important, but militaries are small and getting smaller. In fact, by 20th century standards, they're tiny. In the 20th century, very large militaries don't exist. Forces no longer form fronts. Smaller forces advance into a theater and effectively converge on decisive urban areas. They're transport nodes, critical national infrastructure, key civilian centers of gravity. In Ukraine, the combat has congregated onto key urban areas: Mariupol, Kherson, Kyiv, Kharkiv, Izium, and now Slovyansk and Severodonetsk.
In the Battle of France in June 1940, the German blitzkrieg punctured the French front, and the French government declared that Paris would be an open city. Why was Paris preserved while Ukrainian cities are turned to rubble?
This is a great point. The Battle of France is an extreme example, because in the Second World War, most belligerents did not concede their capital city or many other cities. The typical dynamic of the Second World War is that the decisive battle would be a massive engagement in the field, and then there would be a final battle in and around a city. So the final Armageddon at Berlin would be an example. That French example is a really pertinent one, but it's an unusual one. Typically, in the Second World War, cities did end up getting destroyed because armies did not capitulate like France in 1940. They fought over everything. A horrible paradox of 21st century warfare. You'll converge on the very thing that is valuable to you, and if your opponent seeks to contest it, you will destroy what you want to fight for. The tragedy of all warfare is ultimately Pyrrhic. As Wellington's famous phrase, there's only one thing in the world worse than a battle won, and that's a battle lost, when we come to urban warfare. It's Wellington's aphorism to the power of 10. If we're going to fight a war, we need to win a war, and we need to accept that, unfortunately, the very thing that we'd like to preserve will be destroyed. The civilian population will bear, as you've seen in Ukraine, the unbelievable suffering. It's a horrible tragedy of 21st century conflict. It does remind me of ancient warfare, where the essential deal between combatants was the person who loses has their cities destroyed and their population enslaved. But although we all think we're terribly modern and liberal, there's many features of 21st century warfare, I think, which are closer to ancient warfare of city destruction, enslavement, and dispersal of the population.
Over the past 20 years, Russia has been fighting in Chechenian cities. Russian generals have engaged in urban warfare before. So why are the Russians seemingly so unprepared for it?
The 40-mile column sitting outside Kyiv for a week was just extraordinary. One of the key things about urban warfare, especially in the attack, you need lots of fuel, lots of food, ammunition to reduce the fortifications before you can even begin to attack. That 40-mile column showed the Russians completely incapable of sophisticated, adequate logistics in the contemporary environment. Look at the Iraq invasion. They ran two divisions, 300 miles in a few weeks. Absolutely extraordinary. The defenders in urban are massively advantaged. I would say a figure of 10 to 1 is pretty plausible. And the Ukrainians have been tactically and operationally in the advantageous position. They must have created depots of supplies in the cities to be able to continue the fighting. The Americans and the British have supplied them very effectively. I mean, what levels of advice and assistance in terms of the distribution of those supplies is always the key point with logistics. It's not just about bulk, is it? It's about breaking that bulk down and getting it to the positions that you need.
What will be the next critical battle in the war in Ukraine?
The upcoming battle of the Slovyansk pocket and that triangle, Izium, Slovyansk, and Severodonetsk, will be the critical battle. The fundamental question will be, who will have more military supplies? Will those two brigades holding Slovyansk and Severodonetsk have enough supplies to hold off the Russian divisions, or will it go the other way and it will be tight because they've lost a lot of equipment and obviously expended extraordinary levels of ammunition stocks?
Russia just retreated and both sides have time to resupply. Ukraine needs to be resupplied by NATO's neighbors. Will Russia challenge NATO from resupplying Ukraine?
That rocket attack 2 weeks ago hit a Ukrainian base that was a depot for supplies coming in from NATO and the US.
How important is Russian air superiority to preventing Ukrainian resupply?
Supply lines are always in the deep battle space beyond the range of long-range missile systems. You've really got to be looking at deep airstrikes. The performance of the Russian Air Force has been mystifyingly weak. They're struggling to identify lucrative supply targets to hit. And therefore, the supply air from NATO countries has been way more successful.
Is the problem that the Russian generals were just as surprised as the outside world by Putin's war plans? Did the generals think Putin was all bluster and accordingly didn't make proper war preparations?
These are all absolutely critical questions. There is no doubt that the Russians thought that they would achieve their mission to depose Zelensky and put a puppet regime in place. So it was to take Kyiv. That was the mission. And it's quite clear now that they thought that they would do that by a demonstration, seize Hostomel Airport, and everything would fall apart and fall into place. The Russians, the presumption that they made was the Zelensky regime would collapse. But they had no plan B. The Russians had a large force on the border from Belarus round to Crimea. But none of those forces were actually in assault formation, nor had they practiced or rehearsed an assault. So they were taken totally by surprise by the order after day three of, right, boys, it's an attack. We're now invading. Because plan A was coup de main plus a demonstration. Plan A doesn't work. So then it's full on high intensity invasion of a sovereign territory with an effective, determined enemy. It's absolutely insane. In that first Chechen War, 1994-1995, the early weeks of the operation were a complete and utter disaster. Russian generals made the same mistake, totally underestimated the Chechen insurgents and their military capabilities. And then actually the Russians reconfigured and they fought a totally dreadful but very effective fight for the city. Now the question is, are they going to reconfigure the forces and create an effective operation in that Slovyansk pocket? It is entirely possible, but I'm doubtful. It's not just a matter of an individual general. Running contemporary operations, you need a professionalized staff and an operational level that they don't have.
As you think about the upcoming critical battles for the Ukrainians, the big issue is, can they resupply their troops?
The Ukrainians have lost an awful lot of heavy equipment. They've been attrited to a far higher level. Just through the force of attrition, the Russians could force a passage through that Slovyansk pocket and therefore create that corridor of land, which is their strategic and operational aim.
Can Ukraine get resupplied with heavy armor?
Great question. Poland, Eastern European countries, the Czech Republic has said they'll surprise tanks. But the actual practicality of getting working tanks and crews to work them to the Slovyansk pocket in the next week, I wonder whether that's possible.
Your argument is that armored battles are becoming less important than urban warfare. In Chechnya, insurgents couldn't get resupplied in the cities. But here, ammunition, drones, javelins will be resupplied, and the Russians lack sufficient troops to win a siege.
Anti-tank weapons don't seem difficult to supply. To defeat that assault, they're going to need more than N-Laws and javelins. You're going to need armed UAVs, deep strike aircraft, guided multiple launch rocket systems would be great, but I can't see them being provided. So the logic of the castle has been forgotten in 20th century, but that is the logic of the castle. It's not that you can't take a castle. It takes time for a field army to reduce it. The opponents have time to build up their own field army and to degrade and then defeat that attacking force. If you turn Slovyansk and Severodonetsk into old-fashioned medieval castles, they buy time, and that could be enough to shift that balance in combat power, not tomorrow, not next week, but if those fortresses hold in 2 weeks' time, that could be quite significant.
How many Russian soldiers have been killed and injured so far? And at what point will that become critical?
Russian casualties are pretty high already. My guess is the Russians have lost 1,000 troops a week killed. If you take 1,000, that's 4,000 or 5,000 wounded. So we're 6-7 weeks into the campaign. I think they've lost 7,000 soldiers killed, probably 30,000 wounded. It's a huge number. And every week that will become more. So then you get also the supply of human capital, your actual soldiers, and I think that will come important as well.
Russian army personnel are estimated to be 250,000. Well, 30,000 wounded and 7,000 dead, and that's 15% of the entire army destroyed in 7 weeks. This rate is unsustainable.
There's a myth about combat effectiveness, where everyone's fighting till everyone gets killed. It never happens. What happens is armies can take about 30% casualties, and then they can't go on the offensive. If a unit or a formation takes about 30% casualties and takes them quite quickly, like they have in Ukraine, you stop being able to attack. And sometimes 30% casualties are enough for an army to utterly collapse. You think of the political discussion over lost service personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan, about 5,000, over a 10-year period. A tiny percentage of the force stretched over a decade. What you're looking at here is 15% of the force potentially has been killed or wounded. It's absolutely massive. And as I say, once you get up to about a third, you just can't get an attack together. This battle for Slovyansk pocket could really be the last throw of the dice.
Can Ukraine benefit from untrained citizen soldiers like in Chechnya?
I'm skeptical. I was surprised that the Zelensky regime gave out Kalashnikovs to every citizen in Kyiv, because that just was dangerous. It made everyone a target. If you've got an armored column coming down the street or a major attack, a load of unorganized, untrained civilians with Kalashnikovs are just a hindrance to the organized defense force. The next phase will be decided by the regular Ukrainian army, not partisan war. You need it organized into sectors which are controlled by companies and platoons to make it effective. You're going to need sophisticated long-range weaponry, the NLAWs and javelins whose range is 1,000 meters. So you need to combine those with the deeper strike weaponry. Well, a citizen militia ain't going to do that. You need an organized force which is commanded properly. A general partisan uprising, I don't think it's relevant. The only thing it will do is get a load more civilians killed. How well can the Ukraine army command a defense of Slovyansk and Severodonetsk? That, for me, is the key issue. And if they can connect those two fortresses, creating kill boxes between them for their air forces or their long-range artillery, that presents a difficult problem. A double fortress presents a difficult tactical problem for Russian generals.
A few years ago, General Stan McChrystal spoke at my book club, and he described his war room looking sort of like mission control for the Apollo program. There's a big screen. He can speak directly with soldiers in the field while hearing and seeing the battle live. Fantastic technology. And above ground, there are layers of airplanes that can participate in the battle as needed. And when you combine capable and effective central command with decentralized, empowered soldiers and air superiority, it's very powerful.
Yeah.
But the Russians seem to have none of these advantages. The Russian generals are inferior to McChrystal. They lack the drones and are on the blind during the battles. They do not have air superiority, and their weaponry is less advanced.
Air-land integration became very important. And the U.S., masters of this. They're so far ahead of every other nation in terms of what you described with McChrystal. The capabilities of commanders and headquarters to coordinate highly complicated multi-layered air operations, that's difficult, but then to integrate them with what's happening on the ground, it's a very challenging thing. To actually run an effective interstate war, you need to gain air superiority. And then for an attack to be successful, there needs to be a complete fusion with a suite of airframes spread out across their altitudes into what the ground forces are doing. To reduce the Slovyansk pocket, that's what the Russians would need to do. They seem incapable of coordinating strikes from the air, and that makes life difficult. Now, there is an operational issue here. The Russians did themselves no favors at all. They attacked across a northern, eastern, and southern front. They've distributed their forces so widely. They have so much airspace to have to deal with. They seem incapable of having concentrated their air assets, their surveillance assets, their targeting assets on one particular area. They won't remotely get close to what McChrystal was able to do. It's not just a question of the quality of the individual generals. What seems at fault with the Russians, the horsepower of their headquarters seems way too low for 21st century military operations. They just haven't got the sophistication in terms of planning and execution to deliver a full dimensional deep close rear battle at the same time, in stark contrast to the US, who have become the masters of that kind of operation.
There's a chapter in your book that wars fought over the internet with Twitter and the global media. Russia seems to be badly losing the global media war. Every day there are new photos of atrocities. On the other hand, Putin seems to be winning the battle over hearts and minds in Russia, where his popularity has been increasing during the war. what's happening.
Information warfare should never be separated from the reality. And I absolutely disparage all commentators and all generals who somehow say the narrative is the important thing, that the information is the important thing. False. Reality is reality. But in warfare, we can amplify reality to encourage our supporters and discourage others. What happens in the 21st century, information is resonant among particular populations. We see that a battle at one site, Kyiv, Mariupol, Kharkiv, resonates across an urban archipelago, attracting, encouraging, recruiting political, ethnic, racial, aligned diasporas across that urban archipelago. The Ukrainians have essentially recruited Ukrainians overseas and Western populations very effectively. The Russian people have a social commitment to Putin. Therefore, they accept the propaganda. We can disparage what he's done, but we should also totally understand the point of this war, that Ukraine is strategically vital economically in terms of industry, but also grain, and it gives Russia access to the Black Sea fleet in Crimea.
Russia already has the Black Sea warm water port in Crimea. What if they won by turning this industrial base and agricultural empire into rubble? If the 21st century is about the value of its people, why are they killing them or making them flee?
At the beginning, they thought they could take over it really easily. Putin was worried about the Kyiv regime becoming part of EU. Although he had Crimea, if Ukraine is actually in NATO, NATO forces are 60 miles from his strategic naval base in Crimea. That's unconscionable because it's not a holdable port. The Russian public are very well aware of the importance of Ukraine to the sustainability of the Muscovite regime and to Russia. And so therefore, at a political sense, they agree that Ukraine should be part of Russia. If the polls are to be believed, his support is very strong. Pre-existing social commitments in war, what happens is those solidarities solidify. And that's what I would say is happening with the Russian population.
What happens next with the war in Ukraine?
It depends who wins the Battle of the Slovyansk Pocket of where the politics will be. But even if Ukraine did repel the Russians a second time, they're going to have to accept that Russia keeps those districts of Donetsk and Luhansk that it already has. It will keep a corridor through Mariupol down to Crimea, and it will keep Crimea. And the flip side of that is Russia will be forced to recognize an independent Ukraine and an independent Kyiv regime at this point with Zelensky as president. And here's the kicker, that regime would be non-aligned and neutral, and that it would not join NATO and it would not join the EU, but it would enjoy good relations with NATO and privileged trading relations with the EU. But if you go for anything else, either throwing Russians back to their pre-2014 borders or insisting that the Kyiv regime joins NATO, even though Putin's driven Kyiv towards that goal and driven the West towards that goal, I think you'll end up with a sort of Korean standoff that it will just go on for years until finally, 3 years later, everyone goes, yeah, okay, let's just accept the status quo.
What I think is truly tragic and absurd is that Putin probably could have got his war aims without war. Why didn't Putin bluster until he got what he wanted?
Yeah, of course, totally insane. He probably couldn't have got a corridor to Mariupol, but Mariupol is now ruined. That's going to cost him billions of dollars to reconstruct. He's taken his regime on a completely ridiculous campaign, which he'll end up with a little bit better than he had before at this appalling cost that he's inflicted. I thought, he's never going to invade. He's not that stupid. The most he'll do is a small operation around the Donbass to make a demonstration, give Ukraine a bloody nose, and then get a deal that he wants. I mean, I've been amazed by it. Obviously, I was naive.
I end each episode on a note of optimism. Anthony, what are you optimistic about in this war?
Russia will be seriously chastened by the experience. It's completely united NATO. It's demonstrated that raw land power is real. air power and sea power is absolutely crucial, but you can't do without an army. The Germans have increased their defence spending. Finally, the British Army, which has been in an appalling state, is starting to take land warfare seriously again. The problem is 6 million refugees are suffering. The cost is appalling, but there is a real salutary, important lesson that's really beneficial to the West to learn.